Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. On our last episode, we had a fascinating visit with 90-year-old Dutch Fryhoff of Hanford, California, exploring how he survived the Nazi occupation of his native Holland and actively participated in the Dutch resistance. If you missed that episode, you can dial it up at hometownheroesradio.com. Today, we've heard about the day his village of Roon was liberated and also about how his family lost its land when power landed in socialist hands in the Netherlands after the war. Before we hear about his immigration journey to the U.S., let's get a few more memories from Holland.
I went to trade college. Think about this one. First of all, I had to be there at 7:30 in the morning, okay? And it was an hour bike, and I had to go to the Maas Tunnel, up into the stairways and all. That's a whole story in itself. So I would arrive there, and then I had to park my bike in the basement, and then there was a box underneath it with numbers, and that's where my wooden shoes went. And then we were all gathered in the basement. It was men only. It was all men. We were all gathered there, and then the director, he would get on a little speaking stand, you know, and it was a Christian school. So he says, "Okay, good morning, gentlemen," in Dutch. And then he says, "I want to know, before we go into our devotions," he would read Bible, and then he would pray, and then we would be dismissed to the class. He says, "I want to get one thing into all of your head, and so you know it very well." He says, "You come here for one reason, and that's to learn. Now, if you got a different idea, you might as well raise your hand now, because if you get sent to my office by the teacher," he said, "you're out. And that means no job." I mean, that was the rule. And then he would read scripture, made a comment on it, and then he prayed, and then we were sent off to our classrooms. And then we had 30 minutes at noontime to eat the food which my mom packed for us, in a sandwich or whatever. And there was a field in front of the school, a soccer field. At least we had a ball. We didn't have the bladder of a pig, you know. We had a regular soccer ball. And so you would go with your lunch up real quick-like, and then you would play soccer, and then you go back in. Saturday, had to be there at 7:30, and you would get out at 12:30, with no lunchtime, 12:30, to school 6 days a week. Christmas time, 1 week vacation. Summer vacation? No, not such a thing as a summer vacation. No. And then Christmas, until I came here, the Christmas to me was two holidays for Christ. The first day you went to church, and they had programs at the church, and then they had the school children put on a program. The second day was the gathering of the family, and they would cook a nice meal, and we all come together as a family. And we would sing Silent Night in Dutch, you know, and all the hymns by the organ, because every Dutchman had an organ. A little, you know, they pumped it, but not very big. That was all, came from way back. It was all family, passed on by the family. Yeah, that's how it was. It was neat, really. And on again at the church, the poor people, and I was one of the poor people, they had benches in the, and when you came into the church with numbers, and you put your wooden shoes in there, and then you went on those leather socks into the church. And then, and listen to this one, this is true too. The church was old, very old. And it had the Ten Commandments, an enormous deal on the wall with letters, golden letters about this big. They had the upstairs, that is where the guy said, "We'll pump the organ." The organ had two big arms, and a guy on each side. And they had to pump the organ to make it play. And my uncles, they were all over the organ garden. They sat upstairs. But in the wintertime, boy, all those people who sat upstairs, and including the organist, all of a sudden the organ would go, "Ah." And what happened? They had little stoves in the church. They were made out of oak like that. And there was holes on the top. And they had a little clay pot in it, and they put coals in there, and they paid for that. You had to have a little money. They paid for the seats too. Otherwise, the Vrijhof bench, there were six Vrijhofs sitting in this, and they had a door on it, and my grandfather controlled it. But my grandmother and him, they had one of those things. Well, those fumes would all go up, And the carbon monoxide will put all those guys to sleep, and also the organists at times. You know, you think I'm telling you a joke, but I'm telling you the gospel truth, man. Those windows didn't open, you know. They only had, they had some windows that open, and then they would open them, and then they complained about that it was too cold on the head, you know. I tell you, Paul, those are, I'm thinking back about all that.
Well, you've seen quite a few things, and I'm just interested in your perspective on America. Well, and maybe let's start here. So, you know, you grow up in a village that's been taken over by the Nazis. They're living in your house, and it's the Allies, the Americans, the British, the Canadian, who come and liberate you. Because I've talked to so many guys who went over there with that purpose in mind, to liberate Europe and to, you know, stop Hitler from what he was doing. How do you view those young Americans and Brits and Canadians and others who came to liberate your homeland?
They were our heroes, man. I mean, we would, whenever the planes would go over, we were in a big group and we would all wave and carry on. And yeah, we did. And we would put a stake and we put a flag on the top and we would wave the flag. Yeah, that's what we did. And, you know, I was friends here with several of the guys who flew those missions, you know, Steve Otto, my racing buddy. I was involved in midget racing in Lemoore. And Steve, he was a tail gunner because he was a short, heavy little set guy. And he would have to crawl from the front through a small area to the tail gunner position. That was the worst thing you can be as a tail gunner, because those German Messerschmitts, they would always try to kill the tail gunner, because he was, you know, he was pretty important, because he can hit a plane with his maneuverable cannon he had, a small cannon, and he can really put a plane out of commission. So the first thing they would go after would be after the tail gunner. Steve would tell me, you know, and he says, well, Dutch, he says, you know, we load up on coffee first of all to settle my nerves, he says, because I didn't know if I was going to make it back or not. And just as we would get over Holland, he said, we get over Rotterdam, or just on this side of it, he said, so probably at your village, he said, I had to go pee. So he said, I peed on a lot of Dutchmen's heads. Steve, he used to tell me the story. He got wounded, and he said, we landed on at four, they had four engines, you know. He said, and a couple of times they limped in on two engines and made it. And he said, and then by the, when they were landing, he said, the third engine would quit and they only landed on one. He said, it was kind of hairy and quite bumpy. And he said, I would close my eyes and I say, and I make a cross. You know, he crossed himself because he was Catholic. And he says, and when I open my eyes, he says, I seen the service personnel running up and put the fire out, because he said usually one of those engines was on fire, you know. Boy, those guys had nerves, tell you that. And I mean, it was unbelievable what those guys did to free us and free the world, tell you the truth. It was really something, yeah. So our number came up, and then we got on the old New Amsterdam, and we got into Hoboken. And then we went to Ellis Island. And that is what I still remember. The nurses, they had this white cap with a red cross on it. And the doctors all had white coats, yeah, with a stethoscope hanging around the neck. And we were all examined, you know. Oh, yeah, we were in Holland already. And now, you know, we got in Hoboken, and that's the seaman's house, and it was all Dutch, huh? And they received us, huh? And we stayed there for 3 days. And we had two big crates, and they unloaded them. The seaman's house would get us oriented, and they made signs of what to ask for. And then they put you on the steam train to Chicago. But then in Chicago, you had to change stations, because we had to go on the steam train all the way to Utah. That was a different, it was a big, monster steam train, you know. So they told us we were going on two taxis. When we arrived in Chicago, we had to go on two taxis. My dad with the boys went in one, and mom and the girls went in the other. And they would bring us to the other station. And they already had said how much money that it was. And dad had a Dutch wallet, and he put that money in there, because they told him exactly how it was. Now, this is a true story. So we got to the Grand Central Station, and there was a sign there, and there was a couple of people standing there. One was a woman, and one was a man, and it said they were traveler aides. And those taxi drivers, they made my dad give them every dime he had. I mean, they cleaned them out. And, of course, there was a lot of Dutch talking going on and all, arms swinging. And that woman, she spoke Dutch. She knew Dutch. She was from Grand Rapids. And she overheard a commotion. And she blew a whistle, and here came the police. She had a special whistle she blew. Yeah, and they arrested those dudes. Oh, yeah, and they came with a paddy wagon. There was a real old model of a Ford type thing, and they loaded them up. Yes, that's the truth. This is really quite a story because we were lost, man. Grand Central Station was enormous, and trains from everywhere came to Grand Central Station. So the travel aide says, he says, she's speaking Dutch to us, and we're just in Hog Heaven, you know, we talk somebody our language. Thank Jesus. Anyway, she says, you looked out. She says, I met a bosmas. It's a family, a man, an older man, a woman, and he is a doctor. And he's visiting his son in Salt Lake City. And they're going to go on that train. And she says, I'll introduce him to you. Well, she did. And man, it was an answer to prayer, really. Because they took care of us. They got us food, you know, from the lunch wagon. And on, they had a sleeper. But we slept in our seats. But they got blankets and pillows. And the seats folded and everything. 3-day ride. And on, we got to see cowboys. Oh, man, I mean, we heard about the cowboys, and we went through all this prairie land, and we seen cowboys, man. Really, we did. Yeah. It was a big deal. Well, we got into Salt Lake, and it was on a Friday. We had a big welcome. The whole Baptist church was there, and we weren't Baptist, but that was okay. They were really good people, man, good people. And they really took care of us. They gave us all kinds of stuff. And on, they had rented a house, yeah, all that kind of stuff. And our sponsor was there, of course, and he put on a big meal at the church, yeah. And on my uncle, he spoke English very well. We didn't speak English at all. All we had was the cards. And so, you know, my dad said, thank Mr. Roberts and Mrs. Roberts for being our sponsors and stuff. And it was all done. And then Mr. Roberts, who was our sponsor, he told my uncle that I would have go to work on Monday already and have a job. And my dad would have a job too. He would go to work for Mr. Roberts, who was our sponsor, and he had a big crew that took care of his beautiful layout. And that was a gardener and stuff, so he would go to work for him. And I went to work for Herman Shoker. And he had an Herman Shoker's garage and wrecking yard on between State Street and Main Street on Harvard. And I went to work there on Monday morning, bright and early, with my coveralls, which I brought from Holland, and I went to work over there as a mechanic. Didn't know his board English, but I knew mechanics pretty well. He spoke a little German. His parents had came from Germany. So I got along with him well. I could communicate, and that was good. So I went to work on the trucks of the cement company, the big cement trucks, and also the pickups, and we had all kinds of stuff, and we worked on all that.
Decades later, he's still working on cars, even raced them for a while. It's time for our final break, but as much history as he experienced in surviving all of World War II in the Netherlands, Dutch was also an eyewitness, unintentionally, to another piece of history in the middle of his family's migration to Central California. You won't want to miss that chapter of Dutch Fryhoff's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.